Hello, this is Rory Groves, and you are listening to a recording from the Grovestead Gathering. We made these recordings to serve as a fundraiser for our own family economy. If you would like to share this or listen to other recordings we've made, please visit our website at thegrovestead.com. Thanks for listening. Sounding pretty good. If you noticed in the, am I coming through the speaker okay?
Yep.
Okay, good. You noticed in the hymnal and the program, I have the dates or the, at least the years listed for each of the hymns. And if you'll notice, there's nothing in the 20th century. Some of them go back to 700 AD. Let me pick up. And in our family, we kind of, I grew up in praise songs. I grew up in Assemblies of God Church, and that was just kind of the way we did it. It was contemporary, and it was, you know, sometimes spontaneous, but definitely more modern than the 19th century. And that's great. I think there's something that's been lost in some of the more modern music that used to be in the traditionals, because the traditionals are here, still here for a reason. But one of the things that I like about, so when we do family worship, we pretty much only sing the hymns because we just want our kids to be able to be familiar with the hymns. They're not getting it in most churches that we've been to. Occasionally there's a hymn, but we just feel like we want to round it out, and so they know the hymns of the Christian church. And the other thing I like about it is community has been such a theme on our hearts for so many years, and it's just been, for Becca and I, it's been really the call of our hearts is to build community, to gather people together. And I like the fact that, say, All Creatures of Our God and King, which we sang this morning, was written by St. Francis of Assisi in 1225 AD. It's like we're joining a community of saints 1,000 years ago. And I don't want to overlook that just because we're in a modern day and age, we have to start it all over again. I mean, we are joining a choir that has been singing these songs for hundreds of years. And so, anyway, we just really value the Christians and the faith that has gone before us, and we want to honor in that tradition. And I also like them because most of these hymns are, you know, they're singable. You can actually sing the songs in most voices, and they're great tunes, and like I said, there's a reason they're still around. So the title for my talk this morning is "Will Work for Food, the Economics of Self-Sufficiency." Will Work for Food. This has been a, this is one I could just give off the top of my head anyway, but as we moved out here, I moved out of being a computer programmer into a homesteader, so I took about as broad of a spectrum slide as you can take, and the whole time that I was out here and we were working and we had this property and I wanted to make it productive and I wasn't quite sure, you know, how are we going to turn this into a business, how can that be a revenue stream, all these different things. And one of the things I figured out right away, right off the bat, was I'm going to have to sell a lot of eggs to replace my income as a computer programmer. I mean, $3 a dozen here, maybe four I can squeeze out. Let's see, let's do the math here. I don't know if that's going to work. So there's just a tremendous amount of work that goes into homesteading. You know, we have goats out here and sheep and just keeping them in the grove from day to day in the fenced-in areas is enough work of its own. How many times we walk outside to start something and, oh, they're outside the fence again. We got to go find the hole and patch it. Becca likes to say farming is just fencing. Can I tell her revenue stream? That's a T-shirt. That's her revenue stream. She's going to make T-shirts that say farming is just fencing. That we'll have injured animals. I walked outside probably to come do something to prepare for this event. Yeah, I think I was working on the trim in these windows. And one of our sheep had wound itself up in the electric fence. Now, it wasn't on, fortunately, but it had wound itself up so bad it was just sitting like completely trapped in this cobweb of electric fences. And I don't know how long it had been there. It must have happened overnight. So you got to drop everything you're doing, and you have to go out and untangle, and we had to cut through the fence, and it gets up and it's limping away, and you're like, oh my goodness. So then I'll finish this story, because I went and get, there's a Benamine, which is kind of like a, you know, Tylenol for sheep, and it's an injection. Everything's pretty much an injection unless you're drenching them in the mouth. But trying to get a anything into a sheep's mouth or into a sheep's muscle tissue is not an easy ordeal, and it's 10 times as hard when they're in the pasture. This guy or this gal was limping, so I had to creep up to it so that it wouldn't run away on its limping leg. But then it was still able to outrun me, so then I finally just had to run after it, and I tackled it, you know, like a football player, held it on the ground, and given it an injection. I'm like, boy, I hope this, I'm doing right by you, right? First, do no harm. So I give it the injection, and then I get off and back away and leave it alone, and she came back just fine. Sheep are incredibly resilient. By the way, they say with sheep, you know, one of the first symptoms of illness is? Death. It's a predator instinct. They can be extremely ill and never show any signs. It's a predator defense mechanism. So, but anyways, you know, taking care of these animals, harvesting from the garden. I mean, how many of us go out and we have these grandiose dreams of these gardens? We're planting our tomatoes. How many, who said they had, they're not here today, 18 tomato plants in their new garden this year, and you put so much work, you water it, you weed it, and then after, you know, late June, you're like, it's time to weed again. In July, everything's just going to pot, and finally the harvest comes in August, and you're like, why did we grow all this stuff? Now we have to spend our whole month harvesting, and we got to can it, and we got to, you know, prune it, and we got to do all these other things just to preserve. We put in all that effort, honey. We can't just like leave it now. It's going to waste. Get out there, kids. Pick those cucumbers. We're eating cucumbers for dinner. We're eating kale again. I know we've had it 10 days in a row. It's the only thing that we can eat right now. We're eating that kale. It's good for you. So, it's a lot of work, right? And we know that it's a lot of work. And I want to like, I just want to say, it's okay. We can work for food. And there are some values there that I'm going to go into today that are beyond what meets the eye necessarily. I mean, obviously there's a healthier lifestyle, you're active, you don't, Becca calls it farm fit. We don't need to join a club if you have a farm and you're doing all these things, you're constantly active. You have better and healthier food, you have opportunities to work together as a family. Really, quite honestly, unlike any other profession out there, it can integrate a family of all ages, even especially elderly people who have not only wisdom, but they have there are meaningful projects on a farm that elderly and very young children can participate in. I wrote this one morning in my journal. It said, this morning I ate a simple breakfast from the produce of our farm, steak and eggs and asparagus. The eggs came from our free-range chickens. The asparagus was picked fresh from our garden. The steak came from another homesteading family in our church from whom we buy our annual supply of grass-fed beef. Not only is this meal healthy and delicious, it supports another family in our community, enabling them to pursue a more self-sufficient life. If this meal were to be served in a restaurant, it would be fancy fare and expensive. In truth, it would be nearly impossible to find this meal with ingredients picked fresh this morning at any restaurant for any price. And this is the part of the economy of self-sufficiency. And I'm not a purist, not here. I don't eat steak and eggs every day. I mean, I have cereal a lot of days of the week. And sometimes, if you twist my kid's arm, they might say they see Dad eating ramen noodles for lunch. Without the grocery stores, we would starve, but we're moving in the right direction. Year by year, little by little, we're getting closer and we're doing more of what we can on our own. So what's the point of me bringing all this up? Well, a lot of times, you will hear people complain, as I was talking about how much work it is just to grow your own food. One example is when we first moved here, one of the things I was really excited to do was it had maple trees. I wanted to tap the maple trees and make our own maple syrup. And I called a friend of mine who had been a farmer in this area for a long time, more of a conventional farmer. And I had gotten to know him, and I was excitedly telling him, yeah, I want to tap my own maple trees. We're going to make maple syrup. He just said, that's a lot of work. And I remember thinking, so what? It's free maple syrup from our trees. I mean, what could be better than that? And so, you know, sometimes you'll hear, like I saw a meme one time. It said, growing tomatoes is the best way to devote 3 months of your life to saving $2.17. You know, how much cheaper is it to buy from the grocery store? But I wanted to make the case here this morning that there's a lot more value and economic value to self-sufficiency than meets the eye. You can't simply look at the grocery store prices and make a fair comparison. Back in the 20s and 30s, a group of authors that came to be known as the Southern Agrarians warned about the rise of industrialism and proposed a return to agrarian ideals. Their work continues to impact people today, and if you've ever read Wendell Berry, Gene Logsdon, or Alan Carlson, you've been reading a continuation of their philosophies. They started a periodical called Free America, and it ran for about 2 decades, basically between the world wars. This book called Land and Liberty was compiled by Alan Carlson and is available and is kind of a compendium of Free America. So it actually has published articles from those periodicals on, and it's all organized by all these topics that we're talking about today, agrarianism and distributism and G.K. Chesterton and all of these great minds and great thinkers. They were hashing all this stuff out in the 20s and 30s and 40s. And, I mean, it kind of went away after the Second World War as considered to be, like, a viable alternative. But people have been turning their attention back to it in the last few decades because they just kind of see these two logical consequences, one of socialism, which isn't going to work out, and one of infinite capitalism or market capitalism, which isn't going to work out. On a broad scale, there needs to be distributed property and lots of people with skin in the game invested in growing their own food, invested in growing their own productive households. One of the things they discussed was the difference between exchange value, what we commonly refer to as a product's price, and use value, the usefulness of having the product. So in the preface to the book, Sir Roger Scruton writes, "The so-called science of economics had, they believed, gotten off to the wrong start by taking exchange value as its primary subject matter." In other words, you know, the field of economics is not all that old. Adam Smith wrote Wealth of Nations in 1789. It was still kind of a burgeoning science, economics as a science, back at the turn of the century. So they're saying they got off track by focusing on the price of a product instead of the use of a product. He said, as a result, it measured a country's wealth in terms of commodities and committed itself to an economy in constant motion. As things exchange, accumulate, and slip from our grasp, the real wealth a country, they argued, the real wealth of a country, they argued, does not reside in the hectic exchanges on the stock market or in the rivers of commodities that flow through every household without belonging there. It resides in local communities, in the work that holds them together, and in the deep investment represented by a home, a place, and the endowment across generations of human love. In such a community, things exchange, but for their use value rather than their price. I mentioned the maple syrup before, and, you know, to tap maple trees, it's a lot of fun, but it's also a lot of work. I mean, my friend was right, but it wasn't a reason not to do it. You got to get some buckets. You got to get some taps. You got to go out and drill the trees kind of in early spring, say maybe February, March, depends on where you live. Basically, if anyone wants to get into that, I'd be happy to have the longer conversation. You have to collect the buckets over the course of a week or 2 weeks or so forth. Sometimes you got to store the buckets. Unless you're ready to evaporate that day, you got to store the buckets. So then you got to get them in a snowbank, and so they stay cool. Then you have to evaporate. So sap is roughly 97% water. And you got to get rid of most of that water. So that means you got to run a fire. And to run a fire, you got to split wood. I mean, you could use propane, but you'll definitely go broke trying to use propane. So you got to split wood, you got to cut wood, you got to feed a fire, you got to tend the fire, we'll get up at maybe 6 a.m. on an evaporating day, and that little red shed by the garage is our sugar shack. And we'll have a stack of wood, we'll have a stack of buckets, and we'll start feeding the wood-fired stove maybe by 7 a.m., and then by 5 p.m., 12 hours later, we're bringing the last of that syrup in the house to finish off on the inside stove. Then you got to bottle it, right? So there's still, you got to get the temperatures right, all these different things. Now, I can go to the store, and I can buy a pint of pure maple syrup for 10 bucks. So I can tell you that the use value of my own maple syrup is worth a lot more than $10. We don't sell it for any price. It's basically priceless to us. It's our annual supply of sugar. It's right here from our own trees. You know, there's all these family memories. If you look on our blog, we have the kids in sleds getting pulled along, picking up buckets, putting them in the sleds. We have so many memories that get made in that, and that's irreplaceable. We may sometimes give it as a gift, and if you ever get it as a gift from us, just know that's silver or gold coming from us if we give it liquid gold. So it just doesn't reduce for us to what the market deems a fair value. And the other part of it is, as long as we have those maple trees, we'll always have the maple syrup if we're willing to put the work in. And because maple trees produce more maple trees, we'll probably always have maple trees. So the same cannot be said for products on grocery store shelves, which brings me to my next point, which is food security. My first reason why you should work for food is that when you grow your own food, you own the supply chain. That's the largest component of the cost savings you see in the grocery store. When you buy your food, you are renting someone else's supply chain. When you work for your food, you're an owner. We talked a little bit this weekend about the difference between being a renter and an owner. We saw this in 2020, with the notable exception of toilet paper. Most of the serious homesteaders that we knew, and ourselves included, were minimally affected by the shortages. We had our own supply chains. And when you're renting a supply chain, you're essentially trading a cheaper price for a lot of unknowns. Will the supply chain be there when I need it? What's the quality of the product shipping through that supply chain? Has it been sitting on a ship for 3 weeks in the Suez Canal, right, as we try to unblock some other traffic flow? How humanely are the animals or the humans treated that are producing that in that chain, and so forth? So you just don't know because you don't own it. This year we saw cyber attacks on meat processing plants. I mean, it's the craziest thing. Our food, essentially, hackers in China and Russia and North Korea are preventing us from eating beef, right? And they're driving up the price of beef because they're hacking these centralized meat processing plants. So who should dictate the prices you pay for it? Well, if you're an owner, it doesn't really matter. It's whatever labor you're willing to put into it. Out west right now, there's the most severe drought in centuries. There's actually a scientist who has been doing some tree ring analysis, and they can determine, or claims to be able to determine, based on the width of the tree rings, if it's a dry year or a wet year. They said this is the worst drought in this whole period. It's not just 2021, but this period of the last several years out in the West, the worst drought in 1,200 years from the tree samples that they've been able to collect. So this literally affects the price of the whole world's beef and meat supply and their access to it. But when you own the supply chain, when you're raising food for your own family, and this is the key, you're not vulnerable to hackers or droughts or pandemics in the same way the rest of the world is. Yeah, folks out west, they're very vulnerable to the drought. But you know what? A lot of them are raising so much food at one site, they're not feeding their family with that food. They're trying to funnel it into the supply chain. If the focus is on subsistence, there's enough, even in the middle of a pretty bad drought, you can keep a cow, right? can't keep 1,000 cows, maybe, but you can keep a cow. When researching for my book, Durable Trades, I discovered that families who lived on farms during the Great Depression would often relate that they never knew they were in a depression. Their pantries were stocked, their homes were heated, they still had jobs. Their wealth was standing in the barn, in the fields, and in the accumulated knowledge of generations. Irresponsible speculation in the markets did not collapse their stock. We have below us right now, not quite under our feet, but if you just walk downstairs and go to the lean on this north side of the barn, you'll see our goats and our sheep. They'd be happy to see you, and they'll baa at you if you maybe would have some corn in your pockets you could hand them. They'd love to see you. But those are milking goats, and we supply all of the milk our family needs for a family of seven from those goats. They graze all summer long on the forest out here. We currently have them shut off because some of you folks are camping back there and we didn't think you wanted midnight visitors. But they graze in the grove for free, just off the land. We hay this field out here, all the grass area out to the cornfield next to us. That's all for hay for winter. And you see it also on this side of the barn in the hay loft. And so, you know, they graze for free on forest brush, and in the winter, it's on hay that we cut from our own field. We take care of them, and they take care of us. The point is, it's not just the price tag in the grocery store that should be compared. It's the price of the entire supply chain from farm to fork, because that's what you own when you have a homestead. I'll give you a hint, by the way, how expensive. Agribusiness in this country is a $1 trillion industry. So the $2.17 tomatoes, it's not the whole price. There is a lot of factors going into that. Second reason to work for food is to help and create and participate in the community economy. Homesteaders who cannot supply all of their own needs often live nearby others who can. They can be part of a community of interdependent families. So I already give the example of we get our beef supply from church members. Our goats do not milk all year long. There's a season after they have kids that we milk from them, and then they're done. So in the off season, we buy milk from a dairy farm down the road. If you're not currently in a place where you can actually do much growing or keeping of your own animals, this is a great place to start, even if you're in an apartment. Michael Pollan says, shake the hand that feeds you. Get to know local farmers and buy from them directly. You'll be increasing your food security and contributing to a stronger supply chain. In other words, we want parallel and redundancy in our supply chains. This creates a more stable society and more stable communities. And trust me, when food becomes scarce, like it did briefly in 2020, it'll be the existing customers that the farmers serve first. This happened to us. My phone started ringing off the hook mid last year after we had sold all of our broilers. People wanted chickens. They couldn't find them. They at least couldn't find healthy options. They were sold out everywhere. We were sold out too. Our customers knew us. They've been buying from us for years. That's kind of how we scale our operation. We don't just have infinite freezer space to just store up chickens. So we serve the people that we already knew. And this is historically how all self-sufficient communities operated. Most families grew most of what they needed for themselves, and whatever extra was sold into the community. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, this is from a book called Loom and Spindle that talks about kind of the industrialization of America, written in the 1920s. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, it was, with few exceptions, a rural population. The material for clothing was grown on the home farm and spun and woven by the women. Every household was a self-producing and self-sustaining community. Think about that. I mean, honestly, when you move out as a computer programmer to a hobby farm and try to, like, live off the land, this stuff sounds like science fiction to me, right? Every household was a self-producing and self-sustaining community. That sounds impossible, but that's just how most of humans live for all of history. Today we practice the opposite. We convert everything into cash. Then we try to buy at the lowest price possible. But this approach destroys community. It destroys supply chains, and it destroys self-sufficiency. It destroys community because we no longer come to depend on each other. And need drives community. I talked about that last night. When we don't need each other, we drift apart. Wendell Berry writes this: if there is no household or community economy, then family members and neighbors are no longer useful to one another. When people are no longer useful to one another, the centripetal force of family and community fails, and people fall into dependence on exterior economies and organizations. The hegemony of professionals and professionalism erects itself on local failure, and from then on, the locality exists merely as a market for consumer goods and as a source of raw material, human and natural. It destroys supply chains when we convert everything we produce into cash, because it funnels all of our energy, all of our output, into the largest possible supply chain, which will always be the cheapest because it's the most efficient. It's got the economy of scale. But efficiency and stability are not the same thing, as we found out during 2020, and we will continue to find this out going forward. Redundancy is stable, and we would do well to have many supply chains. Finally, it destroys self-sufficiency because it leads us into dependence on corporations to earn our income and where at to spend our income. Many conventional farmers today, despite farming thousands of acres, are wholly dependent on large agribusiness corporations. Think about that. Thousands of acres under their feet, and most of them can't grow enough food to feed their own family. Now, they can grow food products that are used to feed their family, but most of the time, conventional farming today is funneling everything into cash. I'm not picking on farmers, because without them, we all starve. I mean, that 2% of our population feeds the 98% of the rest of us. But I'm just using them as an extreme example of how pervasive this mindset is and how it's become so pervasive in our culture to convert all of our labor, all of our resources, and all of our energy into exchange value. And as we destroy self-sufficiency, we destroy liberty, which is my final reason why you should work for food. Thomas Jefferson said, "Cultivators of the earth are the most valuable citizens. They are the most vigorous, the most independent, and the most virtuous, and they are tied to their country and wedded to its liberty and interests by the most lasting bonds." He also said, "Dependence begets subservience, and venality suffocates the germ of virtue and prepares fit tools for the designs of ambition." Fit tools for the designs of ambition. You can almost see the groundwork being laid for all of us to become dependent on the system, because where are we going to go if we don't like what the system starts pushing out? We become dependent. We become tools of ambition. Liberty and independence derive from self-reliance. Liberty was achieved and propagated by cultivators of the earth because they don't need government. They don't need corporations. They were self-governing. The pressures of tyranny were easily restrained because families and communities governed themselves. In other words, they didn't depend on a faraway bean counter or bureaucrats in Washington. "We got this. We're good. You can go away now. We don't need your handouts. We don't need your protection. We're good here." Strong households. Would our country have ever won independence from Great Britain if 98% of our population was wholly dependent on the empire and unable to provide for their own needs? I don't think so. I doubt we would have even declared independence, let alone win a war. We'd probably still be colonies today of Great Britain if back then the founders resembled anything like 21st century Americans. So liberty derives from self-reliance. It's not about who gets elected president. If we want liberty again, we need to become more self-sufficient, and that includes working for food. So, historically, families, number one, sought to produce everything that they needed. They bartered for what they could. And three, money was rare and used only for things that could not be bartered, or as a way to preserve and save for future needs, in a way crops could not. So, it was interesting in my when I was researching for my book, you know, the barter economy was pretty much the main economy. I mean, there wasn't enough silver and gold to go around back in the, you know, late 18th century, and certainly not before that in America. People weren't exchanging money, and there weren't really banks to speak of. There were a few banks around, but people exchanged commodities. They had exchanged corn, exchanged animals. And what's interesting is that the price of corn, I think I looked at it over like a 200-year period, the price of corn moved within that 200-year period about 10 cents a bushel. I mean, today we have, in 100 years, we have our currency losing 97% of its value. But back then, their barter economy was amazingly reliable and stable. It was so stable. You would see fluctuations from year to year, but over the course of hundreds of years, it was essentially flat. So you could invest in things and have an expectation of a fair return. So the point is that they did not seek to convert the primary results of their labor into cash. Money was last, if at all. Their focus was on subsistence, first and foremost. And I think as fiat currencies, which is when I use the word fiat, I mean, we used to have, a dollar used to mean that it was a weight of gold. The dollar, if you look at it, it's called Federal Reserve Note. It used to be a claim on gold. It was at first $20 for 1 ounce of gold, and then Roosevelt debased the currency, brought it up to, what was it, $33 or $35 for an ounce of gold. And Nixon got rid of it altogether, temporarily. By the way, we're still temporarily off the gold standard, because Nixon said in 1971, we're just going to temporarily go off the gold standard. We can't actually pay you all the gold. We printed too much money. So temporary. So I'm looking forward. I'm saving up all the cash, looking forward to when that gold standard comes back. Every country in the world is doing this, though. There is no country in the world that has a currency backed by anything. Our currencies are backed by confidence. It's completely based on confidence. People believe that it'll be worth something in the future. So as those fiat currencies collapse, which they always do, and with it, the trust in banks and in institutions, we'll see a resurgence in bartering. And actually, we've started to see that happen already in little places here and there. Communities, especially Christian communities, would do well to begin practicing some form of barter now. Call it a dress rehearsal. I want to just shift gears here for a last few parting thoughts about the business of growing food. Or starting an enterprise, any new enterprise for that matter. I talk to a lot of people who are eager to become self-sufficient, and a lot of times what they do is they start by looking at their current salary in a corporate job or however they're, wherever they're coming from. And let's say, using the median average, $60,000 a year is their household income. And they say, okay, how many broilers do I need to raise to replace that income? Or they say, how many organic vegetables do I need to grow, right? Now, how many farmers markets do I need to attend? And you start putting out the spreadsheets. Okay, well, I can make $6 a chicken. So therefore, what are we up to? 10,000 chickens. It just makes sense. No, that's the wrong way to go about it. Because what I see is all too often is families, they start burning themselves out trying to squeeze profit from their farms. They're leaving one rat race and jumping into another. They're turning their dream into a job. But you have to think about it differently. You are creating a new way of life. Don't bring an industrial mindset to your organic homestead. You need to think differently about money, about the land, and about relationships. Don't put new wine in old wineskins, right? So keep in mind this idea that whether you're doing an organic farm or whether you're doing a blacksmithing forge or any other kind of venture with your family, think about this as an organic business, okay? And by that, what I mean is allow it to grow at its own pace. Trying to scale up a new family business too quickly is just as synthetic as industrial agriculture. And it's just as damaging. People are a natural part of the process. People are part of a natural process. It takes time to build relationships. If you force it and try to squeeze some profit ahead of schedule, more than likely you'll do damage to the relationship and damage to the soils of your business, like chemical fertilizers do to our soils. Jesus said, "Are grapes gathered from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? So every healthy tree bears good fruit, but the diseased tree bears bad fruit. A healthy tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a diseased tree bear good fruit." So my word on this would be to focus on building healthy soils. And that may mean profitability is a long ways off. That's okay. You're building soil. When the harvest finally comes, it will be good fruit. And this is more importantly, it'll be sustainable. You're not going to burn your family out trying to pursue a monetary goal if you have healthy soil. The fruit will come of its own. I've heard some conversations and had conversations about a lot of you are feeling called. You have this vision on your heart, and you're not sure how to get there. And maybe there's a difference in the family between husband and wife, or with the children's aptitudes, or the environment you live in. Whether it's you're in a city and you want to be in the country, or vice versa, but there's roadblocks in the way. And one of the things that I have learned, and I have chased a lot of visions, I mean, we're here doing crazy things that I never expected, that Becca never married me to come and do, go move on a farm. So I chase a lot of visions, and as someone who chases a lot of visions, I've come to rest in this concept of the loosely held vision. God puts something in your heart. And what we tend to do, or I could just speak for myself, what I tend to do is grab it so tight and write the business plan and make it happen. But often what happens is he's planting a seed, right? Not a destination. And that seed takes time. It's got to grow roots. In fact, most of the growth of anything you do is underground, at least until it's ready to shoot up and produce fruit. It's got to take its time to work and to permeate the soils, to draw up the nutrients, to get everything in position so that it can bear fruit. And when God puts that seed in our heart, if we're gripping it so tight, we're not giving it space to change and be fluid and to grow, really. And so this concept of a loosely held vision is a way where if Becca and I get something that's on our hearts, like maybe like this, maybe gathering all of you folks here, and having these kind of conversations. We try to be very just relaxed about it and just allow the Lord to develop it over time until we feel like we have something actionable to do. One example, our newsletter. We started a newsletter called the Grovestead Newsletter. And it started as a simple way to share what we're learning from our life in the country. And I think we've been doing it about 5 years, send it out a couple times a year. It's grown to 300 subscribers. And a couple years ago, we started asking for donations just to offset the expenses, but it is most definitely a break-even operation. And that's including all volunteer effort. But it's something we really value doing. Now, and what I want to stop here and say is that we value whatever this is going on. We value the process. We're not trying to sell this as a magazine and replace an income with this newsletter. We're just taking little steps year by year and seeing where it goes. We do this together as a family, right? I mean, Beck and I will write articles. Some of the kids will contribute articles. Everyone's there on game day to fold and stuff envelopes and stamp them. And it forces us to reflect on kind of the whole, what God is doing through the farming process and the farming experience, and how do we can kind of distill that for others. So if we, my point is that if we were purely looking at this in dollars and cents, we wouldn't be doing this. It's very expensive, it's very time consuming, and it's kind of a little insane because we're publishing a print newsletter in a digital age. But from this newsletter have sprung so many amazing fruits. Namely, the relationships to you. Many of you who are already subscribers or have come across our material in other ways, but meeting other people who are walking a different path. We get to pray for families, and we get to hear about what God is doing, what He's calling them into. We've had gatherings like this one and gotten to meet people in person. And out of the reflection and all of this writing that we've done over the course of a couple years, we sprung a book. I wrote a book, Durable Trades, that kind of distilled our experience and our vision and our passion for building a stronger household and passing that on to our children and our children's children. So all of that to say, allow your family economy to grow at its own pace. Don't force it. Paul writes, "We plant the seed, water it, but God makes it grow." So don't fall for the lures of quick riches and other synthetic inputs for your organic business. Believe me, I was a business owner. I am a business owner for 20 plus years. I know all the marketing gimmicks. They work. That's why people do them, right? But the thing is, it erodes trust. And when you're in business, really what you're selling is trust. Nobody buys from somebody they don't trust. You have to have that essential component of trust. And the marketing gimmicks that the world uses, they're consuming that capital. That's the whole idea. They become incredibly efficient. Walmart doesn't care, right, about your family. They want to sell as many products as they can. And not to pick on Walmart. I mean, they're all doing that. It just reduces to exchange value to them. So they may not like intending ill will to you, but the net result is they're going to use whatever techniques are legal that work to extract money from you, because that's the point of why they're in business, despite all the mission statements. The point is, don't erode trust with people in order to pull money out of them. Just allow God to grow that business, and in its time, when the trust is built, that thing will come. You know, seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all these things will be added unto you. Don't worry about, you know, tackling. So beware of some of those synthetic methods of the world to grow your business. And don't worry about keeping up with what others are doing. Facebook, Instagram, I mean, these things are a vice for us. We use them, okay? But they are a vice. You see what other people are doing? Why don't we have llamas? They have llamas. What's the deal already? Why don't we have alpacas and llamas? We could be raising alpaca fur and selling it at Northfield Yarns, you know. Think of all the dollars we could be rolling in if we raised some alpacas. No, it's so easy. Everyone's putting their best foot forward, right? Don't get into that trap either. Just follow what the Lord has put on your heart one day at a time. Just follow Him. And don't feel behind because you see other people doing things that are different than you. Your relationships are eternal. God will bring forth His fruit in His timing. And also be prepared for that fruit to be different than what you thought it would be. Another reason for a loosely held vision. Never forget this as well. Your family is the mission. Whatever you do, the business exists to serve your family, not the other way around. If your business ever gets in the way of that, it's time to course correct, scale back, take a break, or shut down until your family regains the priority. And that's that. So do I have any questions out there on this topic? Becca, would you mind passing the microphone around?
Speaking as one among a party of two that is currently considering hobby farming, community gardening, and all of this, with one person being more business corporate minded and another being very organic and garden minded, I wanted to know if you could speak more to that difference of hobbies, hobby interests, because I've already talked to a number of couples, and I know I'm not the only couple in this situation where there's a very different level of devotion and dedication to this idea, not in terms of, like, is it a good thing? Well, of course it's a good thing, but is it a priority? Mm-hmm. So if you could just speak into that, and what dynamics have you found in your couple that can help us to learn what from what you've already been through?
So you're saying if the husband and wife, they're kind of on different...
wavelengths.
Different wavelengths. Yeah. I was just going to say different spots on the spectrum, but wavelengths will work too. But maybe you're in different intensities of pursuing some of this, and you're also having different skills and aptitudes, right? And that was part of Becca's talk yesterday and part of the purpose of talking together and meshing through this. Well, all of us arrive at different points on the continuum. I mean, we all have different exposures. You know, 10 years ago, this is barely a dream in my head. I kind of wasn't even really sure I was doing that. I was still definitely planning to stay all high tech for the foreseeable future. Becca, you know, she's this Christian Bible camp counselor background. She has no real thought. I mean, farms are cool and everything, but no real thought of becoming a farm wife and milking goats, right? So, that's one thing just to realize. You're on a spectrum, and you're both going to be moving along that spectrum one degree or another. So just because you don't feel it today doesn't mean that you won't kind of pick up on some of these things in years to come as you experiment with it. So I guess I would go back to what Becca was saying, is to try to just compare and contrast what can you do with your unique skill sets to be that, so that the sum is greater, or that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. What can you guys do together that you couldn't do individually, right? I mean, with Eric, Lena can do the gardening, and she can do the farming, and she could do the animal care, and she'd be great at it. She can pitch manure. She was an intern with us 1 year, actually. And she can butcher chickens.
And she can live in that little cabin.
She lived in the cabin for 6 weeks before they got married. Lena stayed with us. Eric was transitioning another place, and then she stayed with us that summer. Anyway, point being is that I think that you have a very capable wife, and Lena has a very capable husband, and I think that you need to just prayerfully walk through this, and then you're going to have to experiment a lot. And some of the things are going to work, and some of them are not. You know, Chris was talking about some of his kind of crazy ideas or just things he didn't think that much about were the best successes that he had. And that's going to be the case. So I think a lot of experimentation, kind of just being loose about it. Don't grip that vision too tight, but walk forward with some diligence and then see what the Lord provides.
Can I add in on that one
a
little bit?
For it.
Like 4 years ago, Rory decided that we should do the Northfield Farmers Market and we should go and have a booth and we should sell chickens. And we had like a 1 month old Alden, but he was gung ho about this. And so it was a funny like experiment in something new that was a full on Rory Groves like game plan. And the night before, I remember he and I were in the garage and we were making signage like for pasture raised, you know, chicken and everything. And we were laughing that like, we're like the worst group project ever because, you know, four of our people are just total slackers in this, and they're just sleeping right now. And, you know, so this group project, it was like, you know, but it was really an interesting one because walking through that whole process, even making the signs, I was like, hey, I have good handwriting. And I felt like this was like a gift I got to bear on the whole, right? So that our booth looked nice because my handwriting was looking nice on our signs. And then once we did the actual farmers market, it was like, oh my word, this is all about people, and I love people, and these are my neighbors and friends from church and new friends, and the whole thing was so social. So it was interesting because to me it's like not super into like raising broiler chickens. Like to me that's not like my passion. Maybe that's Rory's, but it just feels like walking through the whole vision then kind of showed all these other gifts and parts that needed to fit into that one plan.
I've got a microphone. Okay. One other thought that makes me think of, there are so many things that we have felt that we're supposed to do, and then we try it, and then some other whole venue opens up that we never thought of before. And the thing that we were led to do wasn't the thing. It was the next thing. And it's almost like, you know, if you're standing on a certain side of the room, you have one perspective, and if you move to another side of the room, you have a different perspective. You can see things that you couldn't see before. So sometimes there's just a little bit of blind faith there that just, we're just going to try this out and see what happens. And then maybe we'll learn from that. Jeffrey.
So I really liked what you had to say about exchange value versus use value and agrarian economics. It's very challenging for me in understanding implicit versus imputed value of things. When it comes to creating your own supply chain, what are the things that, or how did you make decisions about what you're going to prioritize producing versus bartering? And as a follow-up question would then be, how do you find bartering partners?
Yeah, so great questions, by the way. So I kind of decided a while ago that we were going to focus on subsistence. It's not a dirty word in my mind. Subsistence is just fine. You're living pretty well if you can subsist with your own family off the land. For us, it took a number of years in terms of figuring out what we even like to grow. Like, we don't grow beans. Like, we would grow them all these years, and we just didn't like them. We just don't like green beans. So we don't grow green beans anymore. But we'll raise a lot of tomatoes, a lot of potatoes, a lot of onions. Those things keep well. And so there was a process, a multi-year process. The thing you got to keep in mind is that most of you here, if you're even inclined this way at all, but you're not already doing it, you're probably like us, you're first generation farmers. So you're starting over in a culture that had been practiced for thousands of years and passed down for thousands of years. You would have had been mentored into all of these questions. Like, how do we grow enough food? I talked to an Amish guy one time, he wasn't Amish anymore, but it was at a conference, and I said, so, like, if there was no food in the grocery stores, would you know how to like grow everything that you need to eat off the land? He's like, oh yeah. It's like, wow. You know, like, can I hang out with you a little bit longer? Because it's like science fiction all over again. And I said, well, really? I said, like, how many potatoes would you grow? Like, how big of a plot of potatoes? And he's like, oh, about, you know, this size of a room for like a family of five. Wow, that's pretty awesome. But that's just passed down to him. I mean, you'd know these things. So you have to give yourself grace in the sense that you're starting over. I mean, first-generation farming, right? That goes all the way back to Cain. So you've got a lot to learn. There's only so much you can do. And what was the second part of your question?
How did you find bartering partners?
Okay, our local church. We have a house church that meets here. We also have a church in Northfield. But the house church that meets here is like almost all homesteaders. They're almost all homeschoolers. They're doing like what we're doing. They're first generation farmers, and so we're finding opportunities with them, and we're starting some of these conversations of like, hey, you know, you seem to do really good with watermelons. You want to just grow a bunch of watermelons, and we'll grow pumpkins, and maybe we could do some exchange. And so we're having those kind of conversations with. It's got to be more kind of kindred spirits that understand where you're going with that. And they'll understand the barter principle. All right. Well, thanks for coming. We're going to break for lunch, and we're going.